You're listening to Blind Entrepreneurship, an interview series podcast that highlights the stories of the top business professionals around the world. In each episode, we explore how entrepreneurs overcame blindness in business in order to execute their vision. Today's episode is sponsored by Penji. Are you in charge of marketing for your business and need graphic design support? Let Penji design anything you need for your business, from a logo to your marketing materials, sales sheets, social media content, and so much more. Penji helps you achieve more with unlimited graphic design support, daily output, and a dedicated project manager, all at one flat monthly rate. We have an exclusive offer to the blind entrepreneur community. Head over to penji.co and use the coupon code BLIND for 15% off your first month. Again, that's penji.co, P-E-N-J-I.co, and use the coupon code BLIND for 15% off your first month of Penji. And now, let's get to today's episode.
Dan, welcome to the show.
Hey, welcome. Thanks for having me, Jonathan. It's super exciting.
You're on my podcast now. You're on my
domain. I'm like, right? What am I doing?
Well, I totally get it. Podcast days are Fridays for me too. Today's a Friday, recording this on January 31st, so the very end of the month, ready to start February. But I want to just set the groundwork. I said thank you to you off air, but I want to say on air as well, because it reminds people to actually go ahead and follow you. And in the very beginning of Penji's creation, you Google, or if you go on YouTube and you say, how the hell does SaaS work and how do you get sales? There's a 99% chance that your videos are going to show up. And so you have a quote on your website, actually, that says, and for a few years there, I was running blind. And this podcast is all about blindness. But I would like to ask the first question about your blindness. What were some of the blind spots when you first started running your businesses?
Yeah, well, Jonathan, my mission today for this podcast is to be the best podcast you ever had, like ever. Right. In the history of your podcast. So I'm going to give you 100%. You can ask me any cool question, the real deal, the behind the scenes. The blind spots, I mean, there's so many. Like when I started off, it sounds kind of hilarious today, but I didn't even understand that business required other people. So when I started, I was a programmer. I wrote code. You know, my long story short, software literally saved my life. I got in a lot of trouble as a teenager, ended up in rehab. And it was there that I discovered Java programming. And, you know, back then I was more of an introvert. Like I got out of rehab. I realized I should probably get a new group of friends. I didn't have those friends, so I would just code. And I started a few companies, Maritime Vacation and NB Host, and failed at both of them miserably because it never occurred to me that, you know, having people part of your team was a good idea. So, I mean, and what's even hilarious, so like blind spots, yes, I was reading technical books. So my dad, first book I ever saw was this Ziff Davis yellow book on Java programming. That was the one I found in an old church camp. And then my dad saw the passion I had for software. And he always said growing up, because I got in a lot of trouble as a kid, that if I could just find something I was passionate about that wasn't illegal, he thought I'd do pretty good in life. Mm-hmm. Turns out he was right. Because that's it, for me, it became software and entrepreneurship. And, you know, I always think of like entrepreneurship as the best personal development program in the world, because it really forces you to look at yourself. If your business isn't growing, if your revenues aren't growing, if you're struggling, you just got to go look in a mirror, because that's your answer. So the early blind spots was the idea of team. I solved that by eventually hiring a business coach. I read a book called The E-Myth. So it took me, 17 is when I started entrepreneurship. It wasn't until I was 24 that I actually read a business book. So, I mean, another huge blind spot. If you're starting a business and you're not reading business books, then you're just ridiculous. So it took me a while to figure that out. And then shortly after that first book, which was called Love is a Killer App by Tim Sanders, awesome book, I read The E-Myth. My buddy Corey recommended this book he just read called The E-Myth, and I was hooked. So I actually hired an E-Myth coach at 24. Before I started my third company, because I was just like, whatever I was doing wrong in company one and two, I just didn't want to make the same mistakes. And that was a transformational moment for me, because, you know, Bob was his name. Bob introduced me to real business operations, like the concept of systems and departments and, you know, marketing strategies and sales and all that stuff. And it was eye opening. So, I mean, you let me know where you want to go with this, but there's literally, well, I can go blind spot after blind spot through the whole journey of building and scaling my companies.
No, I believe it, but well, there's actually one thing in particular, which is like a perfect segue to you, how you're answering right now, is the first sale that you have to have. And that first sale isn't actually a transactional sale between you and a customer, is actually between you and yourself. And so I'd like to kind of tell, I'd like to ask about that particular process, because I want to start the progression. I'd like to take the conversation is from the beginning and then rapidly just growing. And so you're trying to make sure that this product is the, this thing that you're trying to create is a good fit. So what is that, that sale like that you have to have internally?
Yeah, I mean, so the interesting part for me is that confidence around what you're selling or the value you want to create, to me always has been, it's just my process. There's 100 different ways to be successful, but for me it was always trying to find the customer before I built anything. So my first thing I ever created that I sold was, other than this illegal CD burning thing, we won't talk about that, but was Maritime Vacation. Let's call it like official corporate business account. And Maritime Vacation was essentially Airbnb back in 99. And it was because my dad had a cottage and, you know, the internet was coming to life in Eastern Canada, and it's called the Maritimes. That's why it's called Maritime Vacation, .ca. And he just asked me if I could build him a website. So I lied to him and told him that the server cost was going to be like $300 a month. And the reason I did that is because I wanted to actually build, back then was Cold Fusion. I wanted to learn Cold Fusion. And so he helped me fund, and he didn't know it, the cost of the infrastructure for me to build this Maritime Vacation. Now, so getting the first customer being that there was value, because at that point I'd probably built a bunch of different side hustle projects, just like that's what I love about software, is that you can solve your own problems. And that's what I've always done. Every company I can point to the specific reason I was building it. But once I got past, hey, is this an idea? Because I got my dad to fund it. And I was okay if it didn't get any customers. The way I got my first customer that wasn't my dad was talking to my buddy Dave, because I was just frustrated. I was like, okay, I've got this site where you can create a listing and I need to find other cottage owners. And he said, well, there's this magazine that the government puts together for tourism. And it's essentially a Atlantic Canadian tourism magazine that's got a list in it. One of the sections of like what to do is where to stay. And it had a list of every bed and breakfast and you know, more established cottage kind of areas. And I full on spammed them. So what I did is I created a database to Microsoft Access. I got my little brother to fill it in. I paid him like $3 an hour. And he would just, he put all the information from the magazine in there. And then I created a mail merge in Word and created a form letter that I mailed out. And it pretty much said something like, if you, because again, people didn't have websites back then. I said, if you want to create an online listing for your bed and breakfast or your cottage, fill out this form, send me 3 photos, and I'll return $30, and I'll return a link that you can use and tell people on phone. Because that was the problem is, you know, people ask like, what does it look like? I mean, people forget back in the day, you had to call every time. Like my dad would just sit there and just take calls like, no, it's not available the first week of June. And yes, we are close to the beach, and all these things that you just couldn't communicate wherever it was listed. And I sent out hundreds of these form letters in the mail. And I said, if you want your photos back, just add an extra like $10 and I'll mail it back. They came in the mail, and my dad thought he, cause again, I grew up in a pretty, I did a lot of bad stuff as a kid. My dad thought literally I was scamming people. He was like, cause he got all the letters in the mail and he's like, what's this? And I opened it and there's cash. People put cash in the, and that was my first, you know, couple dozen clients was doing this blast. And that was like my first introduction to marketing. Like, how do you get your message in front of a customer that has the burning desire, the need, or one of my friends calls it, you know, feeding a starving crowd. Like, how do you find that starving crowd for your service? And even though, like, I got some customers, it wasn't successful. And the big reason there was I called it maritimevacation.ca, and the guy that had atthecottage.com crushed me. Like, he ended up getting all my customers. I priced it too low, $30 a year. You know, I wasn't thinking. I didn't know. I literally didn't know.
Absolutely.
But that was my first, like, get people to pay me for something I built, and I was hooked. At that point after that, I was like, I could never do anything but build companies.
Have you ever sold something that you knew deep down inside wasn't actually helping people? Because I wanted to ask about the internal struggle, because there was the reason why I bring it up is because I had a personal experience where I was selling something for years, and I knew deep down inside that what I was selling wasn't genuinely helping people. And then you switch over to what I'm personally doing now, I'm sure what you're doing now, and you know deep down inside in every ounce of your being that what you're doing is bringing value to people. And the type of person that believes that versus the type of person that doesn't, I think is a huge separation of character and a huge separation of just like passion or grit or whatever it is you want to call it.
Yeah, I can, you know, I'm trying to think of all the things I've ever sold. I can't say there's anything, there was ever a moment where I was like selling something and I'll say this. Have I sold things where I knew that what we were going to deliver was less than what I had promised? 100%.
Yeah.
Okay. So in the sense that, like, when I did NB Host, which is a hosting company, we ended up getting a bank as a customer, and we definitely overplayed our hand in regards to our, you know, security audit infrastructure that clearly didn't exist. Or, you know, when I started my company Spirit Technologies, and they were like, you know, why are these certified people? And I would like tell this story that was not a lie, but it was 100% like on the edge, right? It was a very selective choice of words that made it like truthful, but it was definitely not what their expectations were. And then it was like just really a rush to fill it out. And I think that similar feeling of like, how do you act as if when you're small and still have that communicate? It's really tough. And I just got used to it over time, just, you know, doing it. But I'll tell you, once that, like in the early days, that's kind of how it's done. You know, there's this great story of Zappos where they were selling shoes online and then running down to the retail store to buy them and ship them out. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's most businesses when they start. I know that's true for me. I always sold kind of a further along process or product and then had to like catch up to that. But the cool part is that when that does catch up, I mean, that's what you're talking about, which is unstoppable. It's like when you truly believe that what you're selling is what the person needs. And to do that, you need to be able to say no. So for example, you know, even with my coaching I do today, 70% of the people that reach out, they're just not a fit. And it doesn't mean they don't have the revenue. It doesn't mean they don't want to give me the money. It doesn't mean whatever. It's just, I know who I get incredible results for. And I could literally continue to refine it with my team and just say, you know what, it's this size of company, it's this type of values, it's this type of go-to-market, it's this type of ACV, annual contract value. And I think the more you do that, then the more you do believe that, because you're also able to say no. So if you never say no to a deal, then it's hard for you to truly believe that what you've got is going to help everybody, because that's not true. Like, not everybody is in the right headspace or position to use your service, and understanding that and being able to say no gives you that confidence to sell when you truly believe it.
Incredibly valuable. I think talking to a person like yourself is rare, because not too many people are able to create successful bootstrapped companies. And this is a relatively specific question, but with a very brief backstory, when you grow a business with your own money, you become incredibly creative with how you do things, how you run the business, how you spend money. And I wanted to know, what are your thoughts overall on spending money in your businesses now and making those investments now than what they were in the very beginning? Is that person still relatively the same?
Not at all. And I'll tell you, the big difference is, you know, one of my mentors is, you know, he's multi-billionaire, and he said, being cheap is extremely expensive. Mm. And I think that was what I was plagued with in the early days, where, I did invest in people, right? So there's this like a whole thing, like, you know, what if I train my team and then they leave? It's like, you know, then the response is, well, what if you don't and they stay? Right. Mm-hmm. So there's things like that, or, you know, undervaluing your time and your ability to create strategic value and doing things that could be lower value. And it's not a status thing. It's not like I'm better than that. But, you know, in the early days of building my companies, especially with Sphere, I mean, I would go in every Sunday for 4 hours to process our mail. And one day I just asked myself, I said, I can't imagine, you know, we were about 20 or 12 people, 100 million in revenue. And I was like, there's no way that CEOs process their own mail. Like, this doesn't make sense. What am I missing? You know, and somebody's like, well, you need an assistant. And mm-hmm. I dug into that, and I literally have not touched physical mail in, when would that be, 2005? So 15 years. I've had this girl, Lisa, to this day, she comes to my house with anything that shows up. It all goes to one PO box. She processes all my companies, sends it, drops it off. And she shows up in my house every week with any like physical things that need to be delivered to me. And it's things like that. So it's like the way I used to spend money was less efficient. And now it's just continued to go more to, for me, it's all about creating gross margin. And that might sound super nerdy and financial, but I don't care, because that to me is all that matters is, you know, gross margin is the lifeline of a business, you know, because it creates cash flow and cash. And the ability to look at, you know, labor efficiency rates, cost of goods sold, you know, CAC, cost to acquire a customer, your payback period, or what I look at predominantly is return on ad spend. I'm just, today, my approach to investing a dollar is very much driven towards top line growth and gross margin creation. And to do that, you need to invest in your team. So that's, I think that's the thing I didn't understand early, is at scale. And I think 12 is this weird number. 12 is where all of a sudden you need to start like creating departments. You can get away with it for 12 people, usually a million in revenue, but a million plus, you need to start working by delegating to other people. You can't have 12 direct reports, as an example, although a lot of people do. And it's at that point where I realized that for you to grow your business, and for me to grow back then, was I had to invest in the people, and I had to work through the people. And that, and people are like, well, how does that contribute to gross margin or top line revenue? Well, you know, my mentor saying to me, you know, being cheap is very expensive. You know, if you're not paying somebody, so this is like this whole other talk just around people, hiring people because they're cheap and they're easy, like family members or cousins, or like, you know, you ask, it's so funny how little due diligence people put into a team member, right? Like they'll just post on Facebook, does anybody know a designer? And somebody's like, I got this friend, Bob. It's like, great, I'm hiring Bob. Mm-hmm. That's ridiculous. Like my recruiting process is a recruiting process, and it's both referrals and inbound and sourcing, and they all go. It doesn't matter if it's like my wife introduces me to her best friend, they're going through the same process, because people is where we're going to get the most leverage to generate the financial income. And that I think I did not understand earlier on, that when I look at where I spend money now, it's very, so this is interesting, automation driven. If anybody wants to see one of my favorite interviews I've done on my Escape Velocity podcast, it's with Toby at Shopify. And he's the one that really drove this home. I've always thought it, I didn't explain it right, was the idea of, if you hire great people, then the only other thing you can do to get leverage is to build better automation around those people, so they're not doing things that are not great work, right? So that's what's called talent acceleration. So the way I think about it is, I'll invest in business operations, I'll invest in automation, I'll invest in information exchange or data exchange, or, you know, I'll invest in the infrastructure to allow my people to do better work, because that unlocks them and increases the efficiency. Right. So like that's a big idea that is a newer one over the last, probably since starting Clarity, so about 7 years ago, that I kind of, it's part of the operating system for how I scale companies.
Well, I want to think of, add on to the idea of not only money, also automation, but the idea of who you are as a human being. And I wanted to know the type of person that you are in the beginning, right? Let's just say that person that's going around calling people up, knocking on doors, et cetera. Do you think that same type of person can obtain the success of $1 million worth of revenue or $10 million worth in revenue, et cetera, et cetera?
They can do a million. So they got 100%. So this is the thing is the breakdowns are pretty much 0 to 300, mm-hmm. 300K to 3 million and 3 million to 10. High level, you know, every industry is different. But the way I think about it is 0 to 300K, you can be a very talented specialist or you can be, you know, a business owner with a couple VAs, right? But to really grow from 3 to 3 million, you need to learn to delegate, right? And that's the skill, that's the mindset, that's the belief, that's the principles that needs to be adopted for that entrepreneur to get past 300K. So that's that level. And then the 3 to 3 million, this is, you can get to a million, you know, like I said, plus or minus, you can have some people, 12 people, but to get to three, you need to learn to work through people. And that is really tough for a lot of people because all of a sudden the first level it's I'm accountable to the customer, but I'm building operations behind me. So that's the 300K. But to go from 3 to 3 million, I need to now put other people in the front line to interact with either customers, vendors, partners, you know, even accounts receivables, payables, the financial side, right? Where you're not doing it no more, somebody else is doing it. Then the third level to go from 3 to 10, that's where you need to learn how to work through systems, right? Where you're, it's not even just the people anymore. You've designed the systems that the people execute on, and they might even have a layer under them. So you're so far disconnected from the front line that it's just a really tough mindset and approach to business that people need to adopt. And for me, those were the same things. And that's why, like, and this is not to harp on, you know, I know I coach and it's self-serving to say this, but I've had three coaches myself. I invested over $1 million in myself, right, to learn these skills, both on my investing side. So I've invested in a ton of companies and on the entrepreneurial side, because like that to me is I want to move fast. And when you want to move fast, yes, you can read books. Okay. And I'm a big fan. I've read over 1,000 books, but you can't beat the speed of somebody who's been there before looking at how you play. This is the reason why every gold medalist has a coach, right? If you want to play at that level, you're kind of naive to think that you can do it without having somebody that looks at your execution, game time, play, and give you feedback, because it's too slow to self audit or self correct, right? Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I would say that's like how I ended up learning those three different levels is just by having somebody be able to show me that's been there and say, oh, so listening on our executive leadership team call and saying, next time, instead of telling the person what to do, I want you to use the 1-3-1 rule, which is one problem, three solutions, and one suggestion, right? And then all of a sudden, now you're not having to be the person, because this breaks down at 10 million plus. What breaks down is that if you're the person that needs to make all the decisions, the company's not going to move forward. So how do you push decisions down to the people, but do it in a way where you're still able to support them and coach them and help them get unstuck, but you're not a roadblock for them to grow. So that's,
yeah, I like that.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there, but that's the way I think about it from a revenue point of view.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And we talked a lot about people philosophy yourself for a large portion of this conversation, but I really want to also talk about the systems and processes in order to create the sales process. To me, sales is everything. Sales cures all. But you need to understand how to do it. And so if there's anything, I know that's a very, very high level question to ask you, but understanding that you know who you're targeting, understanding that you have a good level amount of success with those types of people that you know are your customers, what are some foundational elements that you need to have in your SaaS sales toolkit, so to speak?
Yeah, I mean, first off, I think you need to have a repeatable sales process before you can get anybody else to do it. So founders are always going to be the first line of sales, typically. And the right way to build this, you know, kind of like process is while you're doing it is documenting what you're doing. And literally it could be as simple as a Google Doc, call it sales program, and just copy and paste email templates, record calls, paste the calls in there, like put everything you're doing that's sales oriented, proposal templates, and link it up in this one doc. Because what's going to happen is one day you're going to look at your calendar and say, okay, half my week is dedicated to sales calls. I need to buy back some time. So that's a big concept that I teach, is how do you buy back time? And sales is going to be the obvious one, right? And if you think you're going to hire a salesperson and just say, do sales, and they're going to win, you're going to be wildly disappointed. Which is the norm. I had a client go and hire 7 salespeople because they thought they had a process, and then fire everybody 6 months later. Mm-hmm. So you want to document the process, and through that, you're going to do some of the stuff you just talked about, Jonathan. So like one, I call it a perfect fit customer, being super clear on what the fit is. And this is part of the sales playbook, right? Understanding what the offer is and what it's not. A lot of times people struggle with sales because they sell too many things to too many different types of people. So that's a big thing. The third is, what is the sales motion? So the sales motion could be freemium, could be trial to demo, could be straight to demo, could be proof of concept. It all depends on like the go-to-market. If you're selling an SMB price product, mid-market or enterprise, and then variations within there. So being clear on what the offer is, and then also the steps involved to get a deal done, right? So it's called the sales pipeline. So what are the different phases from a discovery call to a demo to a follow-up to proposal to whatever it is, right? And to me, having those things somewhat sketched out, built out 80% before you hire a salesperson is key. And then when you do hire, the way I do it is I start with the sales support so that you still do the sales. So in most traditional sales processes for software, it's SDRs and account execs, meaning the SDR qualifies and the account exec closes, and then they hand it off to a customer success manager. So you might be doing all three at first. You actually may be qualifying, selling, and setting up on the account, and that's fine. But what you want to do is then start to grab things off of that process and have a junior person. So like, you know, in the early days when I was selling, the first hire I would do is sales support, meaning they would help with qualifying and they would help with setup, right? They would get the customer set up and I would hand them off. They would so first it was set up. So, hey, hand them off there. Then I would train them on SDR. They would maybe man the chat or man the email or qualify, et cetera. They would deal with that. I was the AE. And then over time, you can hire somebody. Either you train that person up to become the account exec and then retrain a junior person. But that's usually the sales motion that occurs when you're starting to scale. And then what's cool is, once you've built that infrastructure where you have dedicated customer success, account exec, and SDR, you can create pods of those people. Sometimes it's 2 SDRs for 1 account exec and a CSM. And when a CSM, maybe depending on your model, could control or manage 2 pods that look like that. So technically 4, 2, and 1. Mm-hmm. But that's the way I think about it. And then it scales horizontally so that really marketing can keep spending. One of the funny things I see all the time is, you know, marketing having a quota or hitting quota and then deciding to stop, right? Happened not too long ago with one of my clients, and they were pissed off. And I was like, well, you didn't communicate to your team that as long as your return on ad spend held a certain amount and there was enough capacity on the sales team, nobody should ever stop selling. Yeah. I don't care if customer success is overwhelmed or sales team is overwhelmed. Like, fix those problems. But if marketing is efficiently attracting customers at the right lead cost, there's an unlimited, I don't have a budget for marketing, right? Okay. I've got to solve problems on the delivery or the throughput side.
Yeah. I mean, that's really interesting that you bring that up about sending the sales funnel on. And it's weird. You threw out so many numbers, but I was able to, and I hope the people that are listening were also able to just close their eyes for a brief moment.
Yeah.
And then, but everything you said was very easy to understand. So I appreciate that. But the qualifying part, and I think there's the idea of spending, say, $10,000 on whatever the service is in order to obtain those leads. But have you found success in other variables outside of just lead generation to landing page inquiring about whatever that is, and then getting the lead, passing it to a sales professional in order to qualify them, and then sending it over to the closer. But the beginning process, like, have you found success in other variables outside of just advertisements?
There's like different go-to-markets to generate leads.
Yeah, like lead generation, I think, is like one of the hardest things to do.
Well, they're hard because people don't focus on them. So here's just a simple concept. My rule is you pick a channel and you go deep. Okay. Mm-hmm. So if I could draw you a picture, just imagine a grid. Okay. And on the top is different channels. Channels would be LinkedIn paid, LinkedIn organic, outbound cold email, webinars, partners, events, etc. So those are channels. And on the left side, there's four different steps to the funnel, right? There's the channel, there's the lead source. How do you get the contact info? So the lead magnet. Third is the conversion tool. So how do you sell to that channel? And then the fourth is the follow-up formula or the funnel, right? Like if they don't buy on that initial flow, what's mm-hmm. the process? And to me, you want to go deep, right? It's like digging a fence in your backyard. Is like, if you just go 3 inches deep and you put a post up, the whole fence is going to fall over. And that's what's happening with most people's marketing programs, is they don't dig deep enough to find a vein that's working. So they might start doing a little bit of LinkedIn outbound and it doesn't work. So they stop and they do a little bit of, they go to an event and they go, events don't work for us. And then they do a little bit of this and they go, that doesn't work for us, right? Facebook ads don't work for us. And if they're lucky, they find something, they kind of do it, but they do too many things at once. I'm all about doing one, going deep, iterating around the funnel, follow-up process, documenting it, automation, multi-channel. So like if I've got a funnel that's working, then if I've got it working for Facebook, I'm going to go try to make it work on YouTube ads. I'm going to try to make it work on AdWords. I'm going to try to make it work on LinkedIn ads. Same funnel, right? I'm not going to change the variables. Because what happens if you look at this grid, and this is why I call it a growth map, is if you do it right, most people should have the same bottom two rows, meaning their conversion tool is the same, typically a demo or a trial, if they want to do enterprise, a POC, a proof concept. And then the bottom, the follow-up funnel with remarketing and text messaging and email, that's the same. So then stacking a new channel on top, that's where you get hockey stick growth, because a lot of the effort, people don't realize the hockey stick is flat in the beginning for a reason, because you're building the foundation. But once you get it, it spikes, because every new channel that you deploy makes the previous channel more efficient, which is awesome. So like if you're running Facebook ads and then you start doing SEO, guess what? Your Facebook ads are going to get better, right? If you're doing SEO and you start doing Facebook ads, your SEO is going to work better. Like it's just every marketing channel you deploy will make the previous one better. And that's how you create exponential growth. But most people aren't going deep enough with what's working, right? Yeah. They have to. I had a client once, I said, show me your revenue graph. And it went like a mountaintop. And then it was like 2 months, it like came down. Simple question. What did you do the 3 months prior to before that spike? Partner webinars. Perfect. When's the last time you done a partner webinar? Back then at the spike. So you stopped. Yes. Okay. You did not operationalize your marketing program. If it's working, you operationalize it. You give it to somebody. They're dedicated to it. They deploy it. They refine it until the channel's no deep. I can't tell you how often people do that, right? They have one partner that's working. And I'm like, are you building a partner strategy? They're like, no. Mm-hmm. Okay. But you want to go do this new thing you have no experience in, but you actually have a reference point for something that's working. That's where everybody makes mistakes when it comes to marketing and lead gen and demand, because there's no lack of channels. Like I literally could ramble off 30 different types of marketing go to markets. It's the lack of discipline and process to actually get them working and stick to them.
That was actually exactly my next question, was the discipline piece. And I think it's really easy to have this shiny object syndrome where you see something and you're like, oh my God. Or if you, I mean, no offense, but like if you watch an article or if you watch a video, you immediately go, oh my God, that's the new, like this person said, Dan said it, so I got to do it too. And that may not necessarily be the case. And so I like to hear like techniques that you've used personally in order to discipline yourself from not actually venturing into this new thing that you're just not aware of.
Yeah. So, I mean, the fun part for me is everything I do myself, I've created a framework around, because, you know, as a coach, I got to teach it to other people. So that specific one of focus is called the three iteration test, meaning that once you choose a channel, You do 2-week iterations, no different than you would with agile development, right? And you run the test and the experiment. And as long as you're making forward movement progress, you know, over that period, then you just stick to it. So if I run Facebook ads, and you know, I'll tell you a real one. So YouTube ads right now, started in December, didn't work the first 2 weeks. It was like $800. It should be $150, right? Mm. Then we iterated, got it from 8 to 6. Perfect. We're making forward movement. Then we got it from 6 to 5, right? Then it went from 5 to 6 again. So a lot of people would be like, shit, that's the best we're going to do. Let's stop. Nope. 3 iteration tests. So just, it got worse, but I'm not going to give up on it just yet. And we just kept at it and kept at it. And like literally 2 weeks ago, boom, we started getting below 300. Right. And it's the discipline of like looking at the whole thing and saying, let's look at the ad, look at the landing page, look at the copy, look at the email, look at the every message, communication, colors, button fonts, promises. Like if it's because most people don't take that level of detail to it. Mm-hmm. To do it. Now, I created a process that my marketing team executes now, so I'm not involved at that level, but I just continuously remind them when they're like, I don't think it's going to work. I just ask them, what week is this? Is this the third iteration? Where are we at on this? And they're like, well, we did a month. Okay, let's stay on it. Because it's, I actually think that it has to be hard, right, Jonathan? Like it has to be hard to make it so that when we figure it out, we've got something that other people didn't figure out because they gave up because it got hard. So I'm okay with it being tough because I know if I crack it, I'll have something that my competitor doesn't have because if they experienced what I did, they probably would have gave up. Now that does not mean spending 50 grand on paid ads to realize it was never going to work, right? That does not mean you should not try to reverse engineer a funnel that you know that's similar to your customer segment and is working for somebody else. Right? It doesn't mean you shouldn't hire somebody to give you advice on your process if you've never done it before, mm-hmm. but it does mean to stay with it in the beginning and deconstruct it to that level of detail until it starts to perform. Or doesn't, and then you know, and you move on.
Right. And you have to be disciplined enough in that aspect to actually move on before you start investing even more time. Because I feel like they're
it's usually pretty obvious. If you haven't been able to tweak it after 3 iterations, 6 weeks in a positive direction, then either you just don't have the skills or it was never going to work. But either way, it's not going to get better because you're not going to change who you are and you're not, you know what I mean? So like, yeah. To me, that's the way I think about it. As long as I've given it 3 fair shots at whenever it started to get bad, if it's not working and try to move it forward, if it goes sideways for 3 weeks or creeps up then, or 3 iterations, 6 weeks typically, then I call it a day.
And I think that's incredibly fair to assess that way. However, I do know a lot of entrepreneurs, especially the people that listened, that I talked to, that listen to this podcast, is they kind of have this hamster wheel syndrome where they're constantly just going through the same wheel every single time, which leads me to the last topic that I wanted to talk about, which is churn. And churn is one of those things where it's inevitable. People are going to tell you you suck. You need to be okay with hearing it. But in order to reduce churn, well, let's just go top level for a brief moment. We can go micro after that. But churn is incredibly hard. If you're bleeding, you're bleeding. And you need to stop the bleeding immediately. So could you just speak to churn and maybe some tips or tricks that you see for the people that you coach and in order for them to eliminate that entire, or at least reduce the process of churn?
So churn is, I call it chocolate broccoli, right? So people want marketing strategies, top of funnel growth, the things we just talked about. But what they need is what we're going to talk about, which is churn. Right? So that's why I call it chocolate broccoli, because it's sexy. They want the marketing hacks, but the truth is for most SaaS businesses, they have a retention problem. So mm-hmm. I actually spend most of my time on the retention stuff up front, working with the client and then pricing and then top of funnel, because it allows you to build that flywheel. Things for churn to look into. If you're in MarTech, if you're an information marketer, which, you know, a lot of those folks are trying to make the transition to SaaS because it's a lot better business model. A lot of them have the bad habit of selling the vehicle, of overselling the product and selling to people that were never going to stick around in the long term. So that is a positioning segment problem. and how you're selling the software. So it's kind of what you said earlier about like selling. Have you ever sold something that you know to people that shouldn't have bought? Most of the people doing this that have the issue are selling through a webinar. So they're actually never interacting with somebody, and they're definitely selling the dream. And that's why people churn. So if you have that problem, you got to stop. You cannot sell software the way you sell information, or you'll have a churn issue. And I'm talking like, you know, clients come to me and they got 20-25% monthly churn. That means you're losing your customers every 10 months or 5 months or four months, right? Like 100% of your customer base go away, which you want it down to like 30% a year, right? On the SMB side, you know, mid-market, kind of like 12%, and then, you know, even 0% if you're an enterprise. The other stuff that we deploy is what's called the cancellation capture process, which is on the cancellation, there's six core things you want to look at or give options to your customers canceling to lure, right? Even if they end up canceling, totally fine. You need to get something in return. Okay. And you want to try to save them, because a lot of times people are canceling, not because they don't want to use your product, but for whatever other reasons. Maybe it's a seasonal product. Maybe it's they're missing a feature that you have that you just didn't communicate. Maybe they're having a technical problem. They're just getting pissed off because somebody, you know, somebody said you should use this other product, et cetera, et cetera. So the cancellation capture system is critical and needs to be there. And it's in the page. And I have a video on it on YouTube where I break into the wireframes. I give you everything, the copy, the wireframes, here's how to collect it. Here's what to look for. Here's what to offer as an alternative. So I would say cancellation is huge. And then what I like to do is I look for bright spots. So what that means, and I forget the book that talked about this concept of bright spots, but I want to find the customers that are winning and try to find out what's true about them and reverse engineer everything from that. So what I do by that is I do what's called a clickstream analysis. And I'm looking at a few things. One, I'm looking at their activation flow. So in analyzing their first time user experience, what's called the FATUI, funny word, but that's what designers call it. What did the people that got the product do in what order? Because that'll educate the onboarding experience. And activation definitely impacts churn, right? If people don't use the product, especially if they don't get to what's called core value or aha moment or must have experience, you know, pick your flavor of terms there. If they don't get to that, they'll never stick around. So I use the bright spot customers to then reverse engineer and sequence my setup to get everybody to experience that same flow based on, you know, what's the 80-20 of my top customers' experience. Then I'm looking for from the customers. This is a messaging thing, because the messaging on the website is probably off, is I'll ask them a question that sounds something like, how do you explain our product to a friend or colleague? And I look for their words. So most founders get romantic about the way they want to describe their product and how it helps people. And what I would rather do is reverse engineer and echo, I call this echoing, their terms, because what they're saying to their friends is what I need everybody to expect. And if that expectation is on point, it's gonna attract other people like them, and it's gonna get them through the funnel, okay? So here's just a simple example of how I do that in my world. I have clients that I coach that are 10 million plus in ARR. Every time we get together, three times a year, I ask them what their top challenges are, right? And we write them down on a flip chart. I then use that list. We do solve them in that room, but I then use that list to drive all of my YouTube content. Why do I do that? Because I want more customers just like them. So I produce content that they are having problems on to then attract other people like them and not attract the people that are at zero, because that's not my core customer. So that's just the exact same principle applied to an information product. But the truth is, you can use this for your activation experience, your positioning, your content management, your content, your editorial process for social media and content. So cancellation capture system, one, how you sell, positioning on the homepage, setup, pricing's huge. So a lot of people don't look at their pricing. That's the first thing that we solve is always pricing, retention, and then we go to top of funnel. So pricing is all about value metrics and packaging and really understanding your segments that could exist. But yeah, those are like the big things. And within each one of those, there's like tactics, like your onboarding email sequence and, you know, your conversion flows or your trial process. And, you know, do you ask for a credit card on file versus none? Do you do a 14-day trial or 7-day trial? I mean, there's nuances in all of that, but all of those things will definitely impact retention in turn.
Yeah. I mean, listening and following you for as long as I have, I admire your ability to think and put things in a very easily digestible way. And your systems and processes are incredibly valuable. So thank you. But from a personal level, like you as the human being, I have two questions to that. The first question is like, how do you create these systems? How do you create these processes? Like just from like a personal standpoint, do you write it down? Do you mind map it? Do you just go on a board and you just start drawing? Like what is your system?
Yeah. So I mean, I can show you because I created a system for how I do it. Look, I'm a software guy. This is software architecture applied to information. Yeah. Like I literally just, I'm a technical nerd. People think I'm a marketing sales guy because I'm good at that. Yeah. They don't realize like at my core, I'm a systems thinker.
Sure. And I love it.
So like I, for example, I have this sheet called the Content Webinar Builder, and it's these boxes that I fill out. Right now, this isn't a completed sheet, but that's the concept, right? Mm-hmm. So I talk about like, what are the frustrations? What are the three frustrations? What are the wants? What are the things they want from this thing? Case study, I always tell a story. Five hot points, like five principles that I think that are unique that they don't think about, obviously. Metaphors for each one of those, because I know that for a lot of people, they need the metaphor to really make it stick. Then I do a model, which is a visual model, triangles, squares, and circles. Worksheet, and then a prescription to really keep it clear and say, go do these things. So every time I create a framework or a playbook, I call it in my world for my coaching clients, I fill out one of these, but I also fill out one of these for webinars. That's why this is the webinar one. But the way I think about it, let's say I was building, you know, just more recently, what did I build recently? My one-on-one meeting blueprint, right? So like how I run one-on-one meetings. I just ask myself, you know, where did I learn one-on-one meetings, right? So I go back to Andy Grove's book, High Output Management. He has a whole chapter on it. Horowitz, Ben Horowitz has got a bunch of stuff on his book, The Hard Things About Hard Things. So I'll like go back and reference that to kind of get my brain back in check. I'll look at what I do and I'll ask myself why, like, why do I do it that way? And what's the principle behind it? And then I just kind of like, once I feel, and then I'll go research. So like I'll go and I'll open up like 30 tabs on, you know, I'll search a bunch of terms and I'll do like the five results on the first page of Google and just read through it just to kind of like, almost like load my, it's like when you write code, it's the, you know, like you need to plug in and it takes a while to get the memory, like all the variables figured out and like, okay, now I'm ready to create something new. Mm-hmm. And once I have that, then I use the worksheet and I go through it. But I draw when I talk all the time. So like this is my, I use Notability, but like I can't be in a meeting without drawing stuff. So I like draw circle squares, always share my screen. Like that's just how I think. Yeah. So I definitely have a process for every type of content I create, including the YouTube videos and stuff. And I do it because what I've discovered from a creativity point of view is the more I create structure around output, the faster I can get into that state, like like coding, the faster I can get into a productivity level and context switch faster. So sometimes I'll go from like, you know, 2 hours of creating frameworks to, you know, jumping on a meeting with my team or an investment portfolio. Well, those are different contexts, and or then after that meeting, jump back into something. I need to be able to provide the rails.
Like that. I really like the way you just explained it. If nothing else, you've already given so much incredible, valuable information, but just the systems and the importance of systems, I think, is probably
and I study, man, Jonathan, part. I've read every book on visual design thinking, every book on model design, on pattern design, on UX design. Like you couldn't tell me a book about any of those topics that I haven't read, because I am a practitioner and a student on those things. Because what I've discovered is that's all I have as a coach. All I have is my ability to communicate complex problems in simple ways. And there's adult learning theory and different processes. And when I decided to be a coach, just like when I was a, like, and I still am a software entrepreneur, I decided to be masterful at it, and it required to do the reps. It required to put in the time to study and continue to study, to be around. Like, if you guys want to see world-class, my Yoda is a guy named Simon Bowen. Simon's in Australia, very underground. You probably never heard of him, but if you find his YouTube videos or his Facebook videos, you will understand why I'm able to, if you ever coach with me, you'll see, I have models and diagrams for everything I do. It's because Simon, I hired Simon privately to coach me in the way he thinks. I've never met anybody like him that can take all these different ideas and visually represent it in a way that's succinct and digestible. And that's just one example of kind of how I invest myself to get better at this. But it's natively from object-oriented programming. So that's what people don't get, is I learned this way of thinking in building software using object-oriented programming. And honestly, most of my business acumen and the way I build companies is based on software.
Yeah, that makes, I mean, it makes a lot of sense now when talking to you and getting to know you a little bit more. I want to make sure that we end it this properly, but I just have a very last personal question, because it's killing me here. You're so system oriented. I myself am actually very system oriented too. I am also probably have extreme OCD to some level and some degree. What is the messiest part of your life right now? Or the thing that is like in the most
relationship with my wife, and I love her. Okay. We have an incredible relationship. But when I think of the area that cannot be systematized, it's that interaction. Mm-hmm. And if anything, the more I let it go and I be okay with it being that way, the better we are, which is hilarious, because I'm such a problem solution, design a solution. It, you know, that's what I love about software, is I write the code once and it works like that for the history of time, as long as nothing changes on the server, right? Like, it's a beautiful thing. That's not true with interactions with my wife. And I find that the most fascinating thing lately, that as we continue to both grow, we're both entrepreneurs, just how do I, it's almost like in switching between, you know, structure and systems and design, how do I then go into a conversation with her and have to remind myself, oh, don't solve the problem, Dan, just listen and smile. Like, literally, it sounds crazy, but like, this is not, you know, anybody that's done any research around this has learned that, that's just how women like, so if you ever seen them interact, and this is, I don't care if you guys say this is a sexist thing, it's just fact, it's biology. Men are more about, what did somebody say once? They said, men, when they say stuff, they're really saying, what do you think of me now? Right? So when they talk, they say, you know, they talk because they're literally playing this question, like, what do you think of me now? Like, status. Mm-hmm. Women, they're really answering the question of how close are we now? Now that I've said that, how close are we? Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, very.
And
very
now that you know those two things, you'll actually see it. When I talk to my guy friends, that's kind of what we're doing. It's like, here's what I'm doing. Here's what I'm, you know, blah, 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 solution, problem, whatever. And then women is, oh, I really like your dress. You know, oh, that sounds tough. Tell me more about it. Look, I'm being a super generalist, but it's just how I've studied the science behind it. And that's fascinating for me, because I'm on a mission to have the most epic relationship with my wife, period, end of point. Yep. So it's really interesting, because it's the opposite. The approach I have to take there is the opposite of what I do in business.
I think to put it the way I heard what you just said, is you can systematize every single aspect of your entire life, but you can't systemize in a human emotion.
Nope.
Yeah. Beautiful stuff, man. Dan, how can people find more about you? All the links will be in the show notes, by the way, but what are some of the key things that people need to find you, follow your journey, potentially become a customer of yours?
Yeah, if you want to learn more about sales, Rocket Demo Builder is my framework. So go to danmartel2lsmartel.com/rocketdemo. I think it's Rocket Demo. Yeah, Rocket Demo, and that'll teach you how to do sales and demo processes. YouTube, if you want to learn anything, you literally search my name plus the issue you're having, and there's probably a good chance I have a video on it. Instagram stories is the behind the scenes of my life. And then more recently, TikTok, if you want to see the more sillier version of me and my kids and just playing around with that, we're having a lot of fun. But those, I'm on all social platforms as Dan Martell.
Very cool. And all links will be in the show notes. Dan, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Jonathan, my pleasure. Appreciate you. Talk soon.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Blind Entrepreneurship. Your time, energy, and attention mean the absolute world to me. Thank you. Because you're still listening, even though the episode is technically over, that means that you're a super listener and you care even further about what I have to say, and that means even more to me. And because of that, I'd love to be able to give you a small gift. As you know, I am the co-founder of Penji, and I personally believe that Penji is one of the best creative services on the planet. It gives you the ability to free up your time in order for you to focus more on your business, so you let us do all of the graphic design support and all of the graphic design help in an on-demand fashion. And because you're listening to this portion of the episode, I'd love to be able to give you 50% off of your first month of Penji. In order to do that, all you have to do is enter the coupon code TBEshow. That's TBEshow for 50% off. Again, I truly believe that Penji is revolutionizing the creative industry. And if you feel at any point in time that your business is not getting the graphic designs that you deserve, or if you ever feel like you're paying too much for your graphic design team or your freelancers, or you're finding it difficult to find reliable talent, we'd love for you to give us a try. And again, that is TBE Show for the coupon code. And as always, I have to end every conversation with the key phrase that it started it all. Go out there and execute your vision, everybody. Have a great rest of your day.